If it's Tuesday, a rare moment for Republicans, with a growing number now criticizing former President Trump for his dinner with a white supremacist, what the public rebuke means for the former president and the future of his party. Plus, President Biden meets with top leaders in Congress, urging them to act fast to prevent a national rail strike, warning of potentially devastating economic consequences. And making history, the Senate is poised to pass protections for same-sex and interracial marriage at any moment, as Congress is poised to codify marriage equality into federal law for the first time. Welcome to Meet the Press Now. I'm Kristen Welker on a very busy day in Washington. President Biden met with the top four leaders in Congress this morning to discuss the lame duck agenda as the White House urges legislative action to avoid a crippling railroad strike. Pelosi, Schumer, McCarthy, and McConnell all expressed optimism that a bill to avert the strike will pass. We will have more on that later in the hour, but we do want to begin with the intensifying and very rare public rebuke of former President Trump by members of his own party, which is once again raising significant questions about the future of the GOP and the former president's place in it. Over the last 24 hours, we have seen a growing number of Republicans publicly criticize Mr. Trump's recent dinner with two controversial figures. Ye, the rapper formerly known as Kanye West, who has made a string of anti-Semitic remarks recently, and a known white supremacist, Nick Fuentes. Mr. Trump says he didn't know Mr. Fuentes' reputation before the dinner. With lawmakers back in Washington, new reaction is now pouring in. Here's what Republican leadership said today, starting with the top Republican in the House, Kevin McCarthy, who weighed in after his meeting at the White House.
I don't think anybody should be spending any time with Nick Fuentes. He has no place in this Republican Party. I think President Trump came out four times and condemned him and didn't know who he was.
Well, he just said he didn't know who he was. He didn't condemn him or his ideology.
Well, I condemn his ideology. It has no place in society. Look, the president can have meetings with who he wants. I don't think anybody, though, should have a meeting with Nick Fuentes, and his views should are nowhere within the Republican Party or within this country itself.
Kanye West has made meetings.
I think Kanye West should, and I don't think those are right comments, and I don't think you should have associated with him as well. That I'm very clear in my position.
We do want to note that Leader McCarthy was not correct when he claimed the former president had condemned Fuentes four times. Mr. Trump has yet to denounce Fuentes' views or his statements. Senate Republican Leader Mitch McConnell then went further than McCarthy after his caucus's weekly lunch. Here's what he said.
First, let me just say that there is no room in the Republican Party for anti-Semitism or white supremacy. And anyone meeting with people advocating that point of view, in my judgment, are highly unlikely to ever be elected president of the United States.
Pretty strong words there. McConnell's remarks come as we've heard clear denunciations from a number of Senate Republicans across the ideological spectrum. Take a listen.
And to invite people like that to meet with a former president of the United States, I think there's it's been clear that there's no bottom to the degree to which President Trump will degrade himself and the nation.
I think it's ridiculous that he would do such a thing with somebody who espouses those views.
I think it's ridiculous that he had that meeting. Just, it's ridiculous. And that's all I'm going to say about it. Just crazy.
It's wrong and inappropriate of him to have that meeting. You know, white supremacy has no place in our nation's culture, and it's antithetical to everything we stand for as Americans.
Now, we do want to stress this is hardly the first time Mr. Trump has faced criticism from within his own party. We've seen countless episodes, Access Hollywood, Charlottesville, Helsinki, the Muslim travel ban, or the aftermath of the attack on the Capitol, where the Republican Party was critical of Mr. Trump, but given an opportunity to break with him outright, many did not. The question, of course, remains, is this time different? The former president's political standing has taken a notable hit among Republicans after midterm voters rejected Trump-backed candidates in battleground races. Since then, we've seen a number of Republicans say it's time for the party to move away from Trump. And now the New York Times is reporting that the former president is likely going to stay on the sidelines in the closing days of the Senate runoff in Georgia. It all points an exclamation point on the events of the last few weeks, which have opened the door for a potentially massive shift inside the Republican Party. Joining me now to discuss all of this is Capitol Hill correspondent Ali Vitali. So, Ali, is this time different? What are you hearing?
Yeah, that is the question, right? And you point out that we have been at these inflection point moments before with Donald Trump. I even remember back in 2015 when I first started covering him as a candidate, there was about a week-long news cycle that we did over whether or not he would disavow the approval and endorsement of David Duke. We've seen this then time and again throughout. In Charlottesville, when he said good people were on both sides. During the 2020 election, when he said that those Oath Keepers and white supremacist groups should stand back and stand by. And then, of course, now we've reached yet another inflection point, having dinner with Nick Fuentes, who's a neo-Nazi. But then also, although Trump's excuse is that he didn't know Fuentes, he did also sit down to have that dinner purposefully with Kanye West, who in recent weeks especially has espoused a lot of anti-Semitic bile, both online and in recordings. And so Trump had an idea of who he was meeting with, even if he didn't know that at that dinner would be a neo-Nazi. And so for the Republican Party, they're yet again at this same inflection point of whether they're willing to completely disavow Trump and cut off the members of his base that might find comfort in these disgusting philosophies, or if they're going to continue to tolerate it. And what we're seeing now is that the only thing that's different about this moment is that politically, Trump is weaker than he's ever been. And now it seems like the calculation for Republicans is whether the political weakness of Trump means that they can actually fully disavow him. Because what's striking to me here is that you see from McCarthy and McConnell both, the two top Republicans, they are speaking out against this, but the way they're doing it is so different. It's not shocking that McConnell would take on Trump in a way that's stronger than McCarthy. McCarthy has his own calculations, though, right now, too, because he wants to get to that 218 number to become Speaker of the House in just a few weeks. He's going to have a really hard time doing that if he takes on Donald Trump at the same time. That's part of the calculation here, too.
Ali, I think you laid out the various contours of this so well, and it's important to hit that contrast between McCarthy and McConnell. I mean, it could not be starker, their word choice. I do want to, before we let you go, get your take on what happened today at the White House, President Biden meeting with the top four leaders in Congress. What were the takeaways? What should we be expecting from this lame duck and beyond, including the rail strike, which we know is discussed?
Yeah, there's really very little that's lame about this lame duck period in that they are so busy. And look, that was always going to be the plan, Kristen. Democrats always had a laundry list of things that they wanted to get done here and that they frankly had to get done when things like government funding and potentially even the debt ceiling. We're going to see them tick one of those things off their to-do list today with the vote on same-sex marriage. We expect the Senate to take that up shortly and it should pass the House in quick order and then go to President Biden's desk. But look, now in the midst of all of these other things that they hope to accomplish, they now have to deal with the threat of this rail strike. This is not a building that typically does well on tight turnarounds, but they do better when there are strict deadlines. It's going to be unclear at this point which one of those wins out. But look, there's a lot of desire on the part of leadership, both Republican and Democrat, to be able to get something done to avert this rail strike. But the dynamics here don't necessarily break down in red versus blue. So there's some complicating factors here that make it not a sure thing on the Senate side that they're going to be able to vote to avert that rail strike. That's going to be a big deal this week, too.
It really is, Ali. And talking to my sources on both sides of Pennsylvania Avenue, they stress the pressure points, the fact that more than 400 companies are calling on Congress to do something in addition to the president. Fantastic reporting, as always, from a very busy Capitol Hill today. Ali Vitali, thank you. Joining me now is our panel, Reed Wilson, founder and editor of Pluribus News, Maria Teresa Kumar, president and CEO of Voto Latino and an NBC News contributor, and Sarah Chamberlain, president and CEO of the Republican Main Street Partnership. Thanks to all of you for being here. Sarah, let me start with you and this idea that, yes, we are seeing this avalanche of criticism against the former president, but we have seen this before. I ticked through some of the examples, the Access Hollywood tape when he was a candidate, some of the criticism in the wake of his meeting with President Putin in Helsinki. Is this time different? Does it feel different? I mean, he's an announced candidate now, and his candidacy didn't seem to make a very huge splash when he made that announcement.
No, it didn't. As the newspaper said, Florida man announces. See story on page 26. I do think this one's a little bit different. You've got a lot more members coming out, making comments about him. And now let's not forget, we've lost three cycles in a row. The Republican Main Street Partnership, which is what I run, is the only reason we are in the majority. And we elected people that are in D seats. And they didn't run on Trump. They didn't even mention Donald Trump's name. So maybe it's time. We'll wait and see.
The last point that you make may be the most significant, which are the losses in 2022. Maria Teresa, weigh in here. How are Democrats viewing this moment? Democrats know better than anyone that you cannot count out former President Trump. Do you think this weighs into the final decision by President Biden about whether he runs again, for example?
Well, I think, first of all, I don't think we're going to hear anything of whether he runs again, and probably until April. He still needs a Congress that's working for him. Mm. He wants to make sure that he gets most of his priorities through, and I think he has. I think the biggest challenge, though, with for the Democrats is, how do you look at a Republican Party that it took them almost a week to actually start condemning these remarks? And part of it makes it like, where you actually trying to poll people and see where it fell. And I think when you look at McCarthy, I think one of his calculations is like, he can't completely condemn him, mm-hmm. because you know who else was on stage with Nick Fuentes? Marjorie Taylor Greene, someone that he needs in order to secure the speakership. So sadly, I think that for the Democrats, they're sitting back and say, this is more of Trump, and we're waiting for more of the Republican Party to come out and condemn what is happening, because it is that kind of ethnic politics, so to speak, that is actually tearing the country apart.
Now, I want to play a little bit more sound from Republican and then get your reaction on the other side, Reid.
Join Hoda Kotb for a brand new season of her podcast, Making Space.
For season 5, I am making space to talk to people who are providing a sense of hope and inspiration when life changes course.
Uplifting conversations with inspiring individuals like NFL legend Drew Brees, singer-songwriter Ziggy Marley, and today's show co-anchor Savannah Guthrie as you have never heard her before.
I found faith more viscerally, not because the bad thing didn't happen, but because it did.
I promise you, like me, will leave these conversations with some wisdom for your own journey, empowered and inspired to make space in your own life.
New episodes of Making Space with Hoda Kotb are released every Wednesday. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
It's a high-stakes election year, so it's not enough to just follow along. You need to understand what's happening so you are fully informed come November. Every weekday on the NPR Politics Podcast, our political reporters break down important stories and backstories from the campaign trail so you understand why it matters to you. Listen to the NPR Politics Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
Sees anything wrong in anything he does. So this is characteristic of his approach, which is either say it was a joke or say he didn't know what was happening. But that doesn't fly, obviously.
Now, the meeting was bad. He shouldn't have done it. But again, you know, there's a double standard about this kind of stuff, and I don't think it'll matter in terms of his political future.
So, Reid, what do you make of that? I mean, here you have Senator Lindsey Graham saying it doesn't matter in terms of his political future. Is he right about that?
First of all, my takeaway is that Mitt Romney looks pretty good in a beard.
We all know that.
Yeah, exactly.
I think Lindsey Graham is right in that this is not going to be the final moment of Trump. I think the final moment's already come. Can you run a Rose Garden campaign if you don't have a Rose Garden to run from? Mm. He announced several weeks ago that he's running for president. We haven't seen events. We haven't seen high-profile outings. And now he's staying away from Georgia. It is clear, to Sarah's point, the Republicans who did better than they should have in Democratic districts stayed as far away from Trump as possible. It is clear to the candidates who are running that they can't be associated with a guy who's now lost three cycles in a row, never won the popular vote, et cetera, et cetera. So I think that, you know, this is a moment when Republicans are able to distance themselves from Trump, but the camel's back may already be broken.
Yeah. What's so interesting, though, is I remember back in 2016 when people said, you know, once the general started, why isn't he more front and center? When's he going to really get into this race in earnest? And then when he did, things started to turn around. Sarah, if you look at the polls, our polling shows 30% of Republicans support him still. If you have a crowded field, again, let's turn back the clock to 2016. That's what happened. That's how he pulled out a win for the nomination.
You're right. That's exactly how he got there. Hopefully this time there won't be 15 people on the stage. There'll be two or three.
You have a lot of people who are signaling they're curious about
it. But I think they learned from what happened in 2016. Maybe they learned their lesson. But I will go back to that 30%. They like his policies. There's a lot of Republican Main Street Partnership members that like his policies. Talking about the man is a little different. So they are able to separate the two.
Yeah. Go ahead, please.
That number you just showed, the 30%, that's been falling. NBC, to your credit, you guys have been doing a great job asking that question for, 5 years now?
Yeah.
And that number is, it was 55 Trump and 45 Republican Party, and now it's down to 30. It's just been creeping down ever since.
And I think to Sarah's point, though, is that they like his policies, but they may not, they're distancing themselves with Rand. And so the only other person that really fills that vacuum is DeSantis.
Yeah,
and
is.
I think that is actually one of the reasons perhaps why Trump actually floated his name, saying that he's officially running because he wants to tear down DeSantis before he actually gets any win on DeSantis.
I think the two of them will have a war.
Ron Sanctimonious, he already has a nickname for him, right? Well, look, the New York Times is reporting, and I think this is notable. This says a lot about this moment, that former President Trump, Reid, is going to stay on the sidelines. He's not going to Georgia in the closing days of this race. Herschel Walker is his handpicked candidate.
His handpicked candidate.
He didn't go during the first election. Mm-hmm. What does it say that he's going to sit on the sidelines?
It says that he is toxic in what is now a swing state, what is now somewhere around the 270th electoral vote. He can't show his face there in an off-year election because he's going to turn out as many Democrats as he is Republicans. So it is, this is... It's quite the statement that he's on the sideline in a race, because let's not forget that 2 years ago, when the Democrats won the two Senate runoffs in Georgia, he did two events for those Republican senators. And there are no shortage of Republicans up here on Capitol Hill who blame Trump specifically for the 50-50 Senate that gave Democrats control right now.
Well, and one of the reasons being is that he was saying this is all a fraud. The whole election is rigged. And so we don't know how much of that actually impacted the right from actually going and voting for the other individual. Right. I think that's one of the reasons why they don't want him there.
And Sarah, I've spoken to so many Republicans on the ground in Georgia who have said exactly that they believe the former president depressed turnout with that messaging that Maria Theresa is talking about. Is Brian Kemp becoming the real kingmaker in Georgia?
Absolutely.
He's not on the ballot, though, so he doesn't kind of help drive turnout in that sense. But could he make a difference for Walker?
He will make the difference. I think if Walker wins, it's going to be because of Kemp and driving the Kemp people out to vote for him. I don't know how many will, because obviously Kemp won pretty handily, and we're in a runoff with a Senate race, so it's going to be interesting to see.
You make the point, Sarah, that voters still like former President Trump's policies. Maria Theresa, when you think about President Biden, the thing that hangs over his head, perhaps more than anything else, is the economy. Mm-hmm. And here he is dealing with this rail strike. He's trying to avert it. But how much is that a drag on President Biden as he makes this decision, as he mulls this decision?
I think that what we saw in November, had it been that red wave that everybody claimed, it would be a very different decision. The fact that it was so close in so many races, despite the high inflation, it speaks to people. We have voters that trust them. And it's not the base of the party necessarily that trusts them. It's the independent, moderate voters that trust him. And I think that actually gives him an opportunity to say, you know what, maybe we have a good thing going here.
Well, Biden has the opposite problem from Trump. Mm-hmm. So Trump, they like his policies. They don't like the man. Mm-hmm. They actually don't like Biden's policies, but they like the man. So it's an interesting dynamic to sit and watch this. Our polling showed that dramatically in November. Boy, they're not happy with the economy. They're not happy with us. Mm-hmm. But they like President Biden.
It's what makes them such fascinating competitors. Reid, we know that the president met with congressional leaders today at the White House. What is your expectation for this lame duck? Do you think anything significant is going to get passed?
Oh, well, I think the vote on to codify same-sex marriage is significant and a massive sea change from where we were just 10 or 15 years ago when same-sex marriage was a third rail that nobody wanted to touch. Now you've got, a dozen Republicans who have voted in the Senate to codify it. So that alone, I think, is substantial. We'll see what they do. I think the debt ceiling is probably the most significant thing that they can do to avert chaos in the next year, because if the debt ceiling remains, it becomes the obvious hostage for House Republicans to force whatever change they want. And House Republicans have shown in the past that the debt ceiling is on the table for leverage.
Absolutely. So. I think that's going to be a major flashpoint. Great conversation. Thank you all so much, Reed, Maria, and Sarah. Appreciate it. Coming up next, we're going to delve into Georgia more deeply. 1 week to go, and Georgia is shattering turnout records ahead of the Senate runoff that we were just discussing. We'll speak with one of the state's top election officials next. And President Biden warns the economy is at risk and calls on Congress to avert a rail strike just days before the holidays. We'll have more on that as well. You're watching Meet the Press now. Welcome back. The final Senate race of 2022 will wrap up 1 week from today when Georgia holds a runoff between Democrat Raphael Warnock and Republican Herschel Walker as Democrats try to add a one-seat cushion to their razor-thin Senate majority. In addition to this race's impact on the balance of power in the Senate, it's also being closely watched as a potential barometer for the former president's influence in his own party. Walker was Mr. Trump's handpicked candidate in this race, of course. But according to the New York Times, the former president is planning to have a limited role in the runoff and will not campaign for Walker during these final days of the race. Meanwhile, election officials in the state say turnout has been through the roof. More than 300,000 Georgians cast their ballots in early voting yesterday alone. That's according to the Secretary of State's office. In a moment, we will talk to a top election official in the state. But first, joining me now is NBC News correspondent Vaughn Hilliard in Georgia. So, Vaughn, what are each candidate's closing message?
Right. Really, this comes down to turnout here at this point. And Georgia has gotten used to runoffs. And of course, when you look at those 2020 numbers, the general election compared to the runoffs at the time, which took place 2 months after the general election, this time around is just 1 month after the election, which I'll let you and the Secretary of State get into the difference there and the potential implications that this has on early voting in the state of Georgia. But for both of these folks, this is a matter of running around the state here at this point and trying to get folks to come out again in short order. For Herschel Walker, it is so much about closing that gap in which Brian Kemp ultimately won, the Republican candidate for governor here, won 200,000 more votes than Herschel Walker did. And so somehow Walker is going to need to be able to close that gap, get some of those Kemp voters to change their minds and come out on his behalf. And then the other part of the equation, of course, is those Democratic voters that have shown a willingness to come out for Raphael Warnock. He needs them to come out again. I want to let you listen to his response when I asked him here just earlier today how imperative the early vote is to him. Take a listen.
I am heartened by the robust turnout that we are seeing, but I don't want us to get too comfortable. These elections tend to be very close. Every vote counts. And so for every person who has shown up, they've got three or four people in their circle who has not shown up yet. And they need to show up.
And of course, we got to go back to 2020 again. It's a mistake to think that Democrats don't show up for runoffs here in the state of Georgia, because 2020 proved exactly otherwise. John Ossoff, who was in a mano-a-mano battle in 2020, he actually garnered 143,000 net vote gain in 2020 from the time of the general election to his runoff. Raphael Warnock also gained votes in that 2 month span here. And that is why when you're looking for Raphael Warnock this time around, he wants to do the same, because his margin was just 38,000 votes the last time around. So if Herschel Walker is able to pick up some of those Brian Kemp voters who were initially earlier this month hesitant to select him, you could see that gap close here. But earlier today, Raphael Warnock, where I talked to him, Kristen, he was at an historically black university. We are about 100 miles south of Atlanta here, the town of Fort Valley, Georgia, just one of his bus stop tours on the day here, where he was making a direct pitch, particularly to black voters, young black voters, making the case that in his 2 years in office, he, number one, helped drive billions of dollars in money to go towards historically black colleges and university, but also helped press the Biden administration to provide student loan relief here. Those were the sorts of impacts that he said that he's had. And he said it's imperative that voters come out to back him for a full 6-year term, Kristen.
All right. Great reporting, as always, from the trail. Vaughn Hilliard. Really appreciate it. Good to see you. I'm joined now by the COO of Georgia's Secretary of State's Office, Gabe Sterling. Thank you so much for joining me. Really appreciate it.
Glad to be here, Kristen.
I want to get your reaction and your take to this record-breaking turnout yesterday. What does that tell you, and do you have a sense of where the turnout is?
Well, we're over 500,000 votes altogether between the absentee ballots been accepted and the Saturday, Sunday, and Monday voting so far. Sunday was the biggest Sunday we've ever seen in the history of Georgia for early voting. The previous record was 37,000. We had nearly 90,000 on Sunday. The previous record for any day of early voting in Georgia was about 252,000 in 2016, and we saw 301,000. And as of 3 o'clock today, we were at 200,000, which puts us on an even faster pace today than we were yesterday. So people are excited to get out and vote. They're taking advantage of every opportunity to do so. And in our metro areas, here's the problem. It's just after Thanksgiving. They only have so many human beings they can train and get to run these polling locations. So we're going to see some lines, and people need to be patient and expect that. And the county is doing the best they can with the resources that they have to get those votes processed.
So just to put a fine point on this, do you expect to see record-breaking turnout overall once all the votes are cast?
Well, it depends on when you do apples to apples. 2021 was a very unique runoff with two Senate races, and I think every dollar in America from Democrats, Republicans, independents alike, all being funneled into one state for one get-it-out-the-vote sale 2 months after the initial election. Historically, runoffs in Georgia have been 4 weeks. My boss, Secretary Raffensperger, was elected in a four-week runoff in 2018. We had 1.5 million voters after 4 million had cast votes the first time. And let's face it, the Secretary of State's race isn't quite as exciting. It isn't going to get nearly as much money as the United States Senate race. So we anticipate seeing a record for a four-week turnout. We will not reach the 4.5 million because we only had 4 million in the general election this time in 2022.
I want to get your thoughts. Of course, we know folks were voting on Saturday, and that is after a lawsuit in the Georgia Supreme Court ruled on last week allowing people to vote on Saturday. Did you agree with the judge's ruling? Was that the right call?
Well, it's one of those kind of things where I'm not a lawyer, but I asked lawyers, and I said, this says you can't have Saturday voting after a Thursday holiday. And I said, yes, it does. So we don't get the benefit of the doubt of interpreting law. It's black letter law. So we said, we're going to not allow voting on Saturday, even though we anticipated we would be doing that until it was pointed out to us actually by a Democrat attorney. And then they sued, which is their right to do. They went to a Fulton County judge who said, I'm going to take this interpretation. Our lawyers didn't agree with their interpretation. We feel like ours was still probably the best one for the entire law. But the judge made a decision. The appeals court, the Supreme Court said, we're not going to stop the stay of that. We're not going to stay that decision. So as soon as that was done, we worked with the counties to give the best available Saturday voting that the counties wanted to. And ironically, in all this stuff, it's going to be the lightest vote day of all together because it was still the Saturday after Thanksgiving. So there's a handful of people that's absolutely going to have helped. Sunday voting was a record, which was always on the ability to vote. And even Tuesday, Wednesday of last week, counties could have voted. Only one county out of 159 did it. That was Douglas County on Tuesday and Wednesday. The Cab County, one of our largest counties, opened one location on Saturday or on Wednesday and had 4,000 people vote. There's always an appetite to vote, and we want to make sure there's many legal options available to people to do so.
So just to follow up with you, I mean, you're saying that legally you had been advised that people couldn't vote on Saturday, but once that judge made that ruling, you worked hard to make sure that voting was accessible. In retrospect, are you glad that people had that extra day to vote?
And if I had my way, we would have people voting every single day. But the law is the law. That's our job, is to enforce the law. We did it in 2020. We got applauded by one side and vilified by the other. Yeah. It was a law in 2022, and we were enforcing it and got applauded by one side and vilified by another. We just follow the law. That's kind of what we do here in Georgia.
Speaking of the law, given that we live in this increasingly polarized country, given that here you are in yet another runoff, a critical race, all eyes on Georgia yet again, do you think it's time to revisit or change the runoff rule there?
Well, Kristen, there's already been a lot of discussion here about whether you want to just do instant runoffs or lower the ratio down to a 45% threshold. Because it is expensive and difficult to do. And a lot of our counties, they've been put through the ringer, having to do all these election audits and, you know, be the center of attention of the political universe. You know, a lot of these small counties, this isn't what they signed up for. They're just out there trying to help their neighbors vote. So I know that the legislature will have a discussion about it. It's not really our place to say one way or the other. But those discussions, I can guarantee, are going on because it is an expensive thing to run these runoffs.
Sounds like you think the discussions are productive, given the burden that it's placing on some of these small counties, as you point out.
I think debate is always a good thing to have as long as it leads to better administration and better outcomes for our voters.
Okay, I have to get your reaction to the dinner that former President Trump had with Ye and the white supremacist Nick Fuentes. I want to read you what some Republicans have described it as: disgusting, ridiculous, and inappropriate. Do you agree? And how would you describe that dinner?
I think those are all pretty good adjectives. I mean, look.
What's your adjective? What adjective would you use?
Stupid, juvenile, ridiculous. I mean, it's dangerous. You can't normalize these kind of situations. And I find it very difficult to believe that a person with white Secret Service protection doesn't have an idea who's coming to dinner or who these people are. It defies reason. It defies rationality. And eventually, I believe that we will get to a point where we're not going to care who he has dinner with.
All right. We will leave it on that point. Chief Operating Officer in the Secretary of State's office, Gabe Sterling, thank you so much for joining me on what I know is another very busy day for you. Coming up, no heat, no water, and no power for many in Ukraine as the U.S. launches an emergency effort to rescue the country's energy grid. John Kirby, the White House's coordinator for strategic communications at the National Security Council, joins me next. You're watching Meet the Press now. Welcome back. As temperatures continue to fall and with millions of Ukrainians without power, the U.S. State Department announced a new aid package today aimed at restoring Ukraine's damaged power grid. The $53 million package, which includes transformers, circuit breakers, and other key equipment, is in addition to the $55 million of support that was already allocated for generators and other equipment to help restore emergency power and heat. This announcement comes as NATO foreign ministers gather in Romania to reaffirm the alliance's commitment to Ukraine. Earlier today, NATO Secretary General Stoltenberg told reporters the alliance will not back down. The Secretary General also reaffirmed a commitment made by NATO leaders in Bucharest in 2008 that Ukraine would one day join the defense pact. I'm joined now by National Security Council Coordinator for Strategic Communications, John Kirby. John, good to see you. Thank you so much for joining me this afternoon.
You bet. Great to be with you, Kirsten.
So let's start with that aid package, the State Department announcing the new assistance package. President Zelensky has been asking for more military and other aid. How quickly can you get those supplies to Ukraine?
We're working out the modalities of that right now, Kristen, to get them that material as fast as possible. We know we're mindful of the calendar here. We know winter's approaching and that there are already millions of Ukrainians now that are doing without power and water, essential resources just to life itself. So we're going to be working with allies and partners to see what we can do to get that stuff over there as fast as possible.
Put a time frame on it? Are we talking weeks? Are we talking more than a month?
We believe that we can begin to start to flow some of this material really in a matter of a week or so to get the first batch of it over there. But we're still working out the details of transportation and how that's going to work. I would note we have already been, as Secretary Blinken announced, been providing resources, material, technical assistance, and of course equipment that'll help them get some of their power back on and get some of their water flowing again. I mean, this is a continuation of aid that's already happened.
Yeah. President Zelensky's warning his citizens that there will likely be more Russian airstrikes. Is that also the assessment of the U.S. government?
We have to assume so, sadly. I mean, we can't predict perfectly what the Russians are going to do on any given day. But if recent past is prologue, then certainly we have to expect that they will continue to bombard civilian targets with missiles and Iranian drones. Drones are getting from Iran. So we have to assume that. And that's why also, Kristen, it's so important for us to continue to provide and to solicit from other countries air defense capabilities so that the Ukrainians can better beat back some of these attacks.
John, I'm hoping you can help us understand what is happening, the situation at the Zaporizhzhia power plant. We have reporting that Russia may be preparing to withdraw from the nuclear facility. Is that your sense? Is that something that will happen? And how significant would that be?
We're watching this real closely. We can't say definitively that we've seen any wholesale move by the Russians to leave the nuclear power plant. Obviously, we've been calling for that since they first took it over. It should not be militarized. It should be led by Ukrainian scientists and engineers who are running and have and are charged and certified to run that plant. It should not be militarized. Obviously, it should not become a military target. Unfortunately, it has. So we would very much welcome a removal of Russian troops from the power plant. But we can't say definitively that we've seen that actually happen right now.
Okay. President Biden met with the big four congressional leaders today, and it comes on the heels of Kevin McCarthy saying he's not going to write a blank check to Ukraine. Will the White House push to get more aid to Ukraine pass during this lame duck session when there is obviously so much on the plate of Congress that it needs to get done? Is that one of the agenda items?
It certainly is. And we have asked for additional funding from Congress in support of Ukraine here right away. So, yes, we will be pursuing that and working with Congress to solidify that support. And we have been very grateful and appreciative of the support in a bipartisan way that Congress has provided for security assistance, as well as economic aid and humanitarian assistance to Ukraine. It's been bipartisan. It's been very visible. And we've been very grateful for that, as has President Zelensky. I just offer to say, there's been no blank checks here. Everything we've done in lockstep with Congress, both sides of the aisle, and with their support. And certainly we share the concerns of many members of Congress about accountability. That's why we're working hard with the Ukrainians to make sure we can get as much visibility and transparency on where these systems are going and how they're being utilized. And the Ukrainians, quite frankly, share that concern as well. So this idea that there's been some sort of blank check that that we've demanded from Congress is just not accurate.
I guess, big picture, where does this war stand? Is there any sense that you can get Russia and Ukraine to the negotiating table, particularly as we continue to stress these very difficult months are now upon us?
That really is going to be decided by President Zelensky, Kristen. We're not pushing and forcing his hand to get to the negotiating table. He has to be the one on behalf of his people to determine when and if he's ready to do that and under what conditions and what circumstances would he even be willing to negotiate. Yeah. We respect his role in that. What we're going to do, though, is make sure that we continue to help his armed forces succeed on the battlefield so that when he's able and ready to sit down and talk with Vladimir Putin, he can do so from a position of strength. And that's what we're going to stay focused on.
Let's talk about Russia for a moment. The Whelan family raising some real alarm bells today. They say Paul Whelan, of course, one of the Americans detained in Russia, has missed two previously scheduled phone calls. Can you tell us when the last time was the U.S. government was able to speak with Paul Whelan, and how is his condition?
I wouldn't get into his physical condition with any detail, just out of privacy concerns, Kristen. Look, we share the concerns of the Whelan family that he hasn't touched base here in recent days. We're deeply concerned about that, too. We are working very, very hard inside the embassy, inside our own diplomatic channels to learn more about his condition, how he's doing, and see if we can't get him connected to his family, as I'm sure they want him to be. We are never forgetful of Mr. Whelan's travails or Brittany Griner's, and we're working very, very hard to see if we can get them both back home with their families, which is where they belong.
Any possibility there could be a deal by the end of the year?
I don't want to speculate right now, Kristen. What I would tell you is that we are continuing to have these conversations with the Russians. We have made not only a very significant offer that they didn't take, but we also followed up with counter proposals and additional ideas and initiatives. And we're going to keep at it. We're going to keep having these discussions in the hope that we can get both of these Americans back home.
Very quickly, before I let you go, on China, the protests in China, the administration's getting criticized for not being as tough on China as it has been on Iran and the protests that are happening there. What say you?
I would say we have been very clear about the right of peaceful protest and the fact that we don't want to see anybody who's protesting peacefully against a law, a dictate, a policy to be treated brutally or in a ham-fisted or violent way. And we've been very, very direct about that. Peaceful protest matters in China. It matters in Iran. It matters around the rest of the world. And the United States will always stand up for that right.
Okay. And we should note that as we're having this conversation, the U.S. did beat Iran in the World Cup game. John Kirby.
Our congratulations to them.
Thank you so much for joining us. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
We do have some breaking news out of Washington to tell you about. Multiple defense attorneys have told NBC News that the jury has reached a verdict in the seditious conspiracy trial of multiple oath keepers present at the January 6th riot. As soon as we have more information, we will get that to you. For now, we'll be right back. We want to go back to that breaking news out of Washington. Multiple defense attorneys have told NBC News that the jury has now reached a verdict in the seditious conspiracy trial of multiple oath keepers present at the January 6th riot. NBC's Ryan Riley has more on this breaking story. Ryan, what can you tell us and what are we expecting in terms of the timing here?
That's right. So a relatively quick verdict that we've reached here in terms of the number of days that the jury has been deliberating here. They've been deliberating about 2.5 days. They got started before the Thanksgiving break and got in a full day of deliberations, deliberated yesterday, and then deliberated part of today. So, you know, this is the largest case that DOJ has brought so far, the most significant case involving seditious conspiracy charges, which is something that is very rarely brought forward by the Justice Department. It's not a charge you often see, and the Justice Department has had a mixed record of success in using that Civil War era law that was brought about in the context of the Civil War. So it's certainly a big shot for DOJ here, and we're going to find out how the jury concluded they made their case here very shortly.
Let's talk about some of the defendants. Stuart Rhodes, obviously the founder and leader of the Oath Keepers. And Ryan, look, he testified that he never directed anyone to go into the Capitol, and yet we know the prosecution had video of him praising the rioters who stormed the Capitol. Just remind our viewers why he is such a significant character in this trial.
That's right. So the Oath Keepers, so Stuart Rhodes founded the Oath Keepers essentially at the beginning of the Obama administration. It was largely seen as essentially a racial backlash to the election of Barack Obama and you know, claims of government overreach. It's an organization that is made up of a lot of retired members of law enforcement as well as members of the military. And what Stuart Rhodes and other members of the Oath Keepers had said was that their objective that day was all about security. But of course, prosecutors had this evidence of quick reaction forces across the river in Virginia that were ready to go upon Donald Trump's command. If Donald Trump had called them up, they would be able to bring in weapons and ferry in weapons, even with boats, into D.C. And they had a lot of really violent rhetoric coming from Stuart Rhodes, who was also simultaneously very careful with his words and constantly reminded members of the Oath Keepers as they communicated in an encrypted app to be careful about what they were saying, because that could leave them open to criminal exposure. So, you know, it's a big shot for DOJ. And, you know, certainly I think a lot of people at Justice Department headquarters down the road here are on pins and needles waiting to see how the jury comes back on this one.
I think they certainly are, as is the rest of the country watching this very closely. Ryan Riley, thank you so much for bringing us those breaking details. And we will, of course, bring you that verdict when we have it. And as I said at the end of the interview with John Kirby a few minutes ago, the U.S. has qualified for the knockout stage of the World Cup after defeating Iran 1-0. The do-or-die match between the two countries comes amid geopolitical tensions over protests for women's rights in Iran. I was also discussing that with John Kirby. Iranian supporters at the World Cup booed their national anthem. They also held signs with the protest movement's rallying cry, "Woman, Life, Freedom." Before the game, Iran had asked for the U.S. to be kicked out of the tournament for a social media post from the team's official account that implied support for the protesters. The U.S. is the second youngest team in the tournament, and they will face the Netherlands for a spot in the quarterfinal this Saturday. And we know all eyes will be on that game. And as the U.S. soccer team celebrates that big win, we are also celebrating 75 years of Meet the Press with highlights and clips from the archives all month long, which you can explore online using your special interactive website. Just scan the QR code on your screen right now. You see it there on your screen. Here's soccer superstar, Olympic gold medalist, and social activist Megan Rapinoe on Meet the Press days after winning the Women's World Cup in 2019.
What opportunity do you see here? I mean, do you see it's like, okay, we got the attention. I am going to make these points. I'm going to make these. I am going to do this activism.
I think the opportunity is in everyone's exhaustion of the fighting and the negative. And our team has managed to make people proud again, to capture people's interest, to make them want to do something. I think people are asking the question, how can we rally around this team? And in that, really, what the team stands for, whether it's equal pay or racial equality or LGBTQ rights. I think we've just managed to give people hope. And with that, now we need to do the next step, which is to actually take the progress step.
Welcome back. We are now in the lame duck session of this congressional term after virtually all of the remaining House races have now been called. One of the last House holdouts was Alaska, where Democrat Mary Peltola won in a ranked choice race to secure her first full term as the state's lone representative. Over the summer, she won a special election to finish out the term of longtime Congressman Don Young, who passed away in March. Congresswoman from Alaska, Mary Peltola, joins me now. Congresswoman, thank you so much for joining me. Really appreciate it.
Good evening.
I want to start with today's news and the fact that President Biden is calling on Congress to override the unions, to ratify the rail worker agreement. It's expected to be taken up on the House floor. You, of course, ran on a pro-worker, pro-union message. Are you planning to support this? How are you planning to vote?
I'm going to be in a lot of communication with union leaders, especially union leaders in Alaska. This, of course, is a very grave concern throughout the nation, including Alaska, with freight being so important to all Americans. But I am very concerned about the fact that the negotiation concluded without really getting where we needed to be in terms of sick leave. I think not having sick leave and not being able to go to a doctor or get care is an untenable situation, especially when we have the flu coming up, we've got an RSV outbreak, and we still have effects of COVID as well. So I just don't think it's right or fair to expect workers to go to work sick as a dog without being able to have a few days to recover.
Congresswoman, it sounds like you are a no vote at this point.
That would be the case at this point, yes.
Okay, and what would get you to yes, and how do you respond to the president and various companies saying, look, this could cause catastrophic damage to the nation's economy?
Well, I think it could also cause a catastrophic damage to the nation's economy if we're expecting a whole sector of employees to go to work sick and repeatedly. I think making sure that freight workers have their immunity built up and can be a healthy workforce, I think that that's critical to the economy as well.
Okay, so that paid sick days has to be addressed before you are willing to get on board with this legislation.
Yes, and it's not just paid sick days. It's the ability to have a sick day without the threat of being fired.
Okay, Congressman, obviously there is a lot on the agenda in this lame duck session. What do you think Democrats should be focused on?
I think we should really be focused on Americans. And one of the big things that I'm going to be pushing is for the Willow Project in Alaska. That is a project on the North Slope. And because of directional drilling being available now up to 7 miles, we have an opportunity to provide a lot more petroleum to America. And we certainly see the need for this with foreign wars going on and the exorbitant cost of petroleum right now. I think that the cost of diesel is a real driver in the inflation that we're seeing, and getting more access to American petroleum, I think, is really a critical thing.
President Biden says that one of the items on his agenda is to bring an assault weapons ban potentially up for a vote in the Senate. It's already passed the House before your special election. There have been two high-profile mass shootings in the past 2 weeks. You, of course, have expressed some opposition to restrictive gun legislation. I wonder what you think of this. Do you support President Biden's calls for an assault weapons ban?
I think that we can't just focus on assault weapons. I think that clearly we need to be focused on mental health issues. Mm-hmm. Mental health really is an epidemic in our country. Everyone from children to elderly people, veterans, we are seeing across our nation extreme isolation, and every one of these terrible events that are happening with mass shootings, they all boil down to the perpetrator feeling a sense of extreme isolation and and mental health. We've just got to come together as Americans and be, you know, focused on making sure that everybody is feeling a part of society. I mean, one of the things about the pandemic and everyone being isolated, it showed us we are pack animals. Human beings need other human beings. We need to feel part of a community. So I think that we can't just focus on an assault weapons ban. You know, the other piece to this is I think that folks don't realize that you can buy parts and pieces off of the internet.
Let me press you on that, because you're saying you can't just focus on an assault weapons ban. You have the president, you have a number of your fellow Democrats saying, yes, we do want to focus more on mental health in addition to dealing with the issue of guns, particularly in the wake of 617 mass shootings in the U.S. and 37 different states in the first days of 2022. Do you want to see something done on this issue of guns? Should the Senate vote on an assault weapons ban?
I am a very staunch supporter of the Second Amendment. This is something that Alaskans are very clear about. And I know that there are different conversations between hunting and Second Amendment and assault rifles. But when we're talking about broad-scale bans, I'm not really sure that we can practically even implement them at this time, because there are so many assault weapons out on the street. And this isn't even just a conversation with manufacturers, because, you know, I have friends who have put together assault weapons from parts and pieces they can order off the internet. You can just build them at home at this point.
Congresswoman, let me ask you about President Biden more broadly and the Democratic leadership. He says he's going to make a final decision about whether to run for re-election in the new year. Is he the best person to represent the Democratic Party in 2024?
That is yet to be determined. You know, I am a very big supporter of our president. I think that he is a very good leader. I think he has such a long track record of being a good, productive, inclusive leader who clearly he's a great leader. We just saw the Inflation Reduction Act pass. Mm-hmm. We saw the infrastructure bill pass, some very critical things that are really going to help Americans down the road. We're going to see the effects of these broad-based bills in the next year. But I would also like to see who else is in the field.
Okay, Congresswoman Mary Peltola, we are out of time, so we'll have to leave it there. Thank you so much. And thank you for being with us this hour. Chuck will be back tomorrow with more Meet the Press Now. NBC News Now coverage continues with Hallie Jackson right now.